This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. My name is Patsy Gill, coming to you from WTAN 1340, Tampa-based Tantalk Radio. Before I introduce my first guest, I want to share some exciting news. A few weeks ago, David Edmonds was on Joy to Paper to discuss his book, Lily of Peru. So it was a thrill to hear that last week his book took first place in the thriller category at the annual award ceremony of the Florida Writers Association. Congratulations, David. You deserve it. Lily of Peru is a great read and one that I know all my listeners will enjoy. Now, to my first guest. She is a woman who knows books. She is the very popular book editor of the Tampa Bay Times, Colette Bancroft. Hi, Colette, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Oh, it's so nice to talk to you. The last time
Good
I spoke
here.
To you was when you were kind enough to speak to my women's group at Congregation B'nai Israel. And you were such a popular guest, and you spoke so beautifully about the books that have meant so much to you. And of course, now you're here today to talk about the Tampa Bay Times 23rd Annual Festival of Reading.
That's right.
This must be exciting for you to be involved with this.
It is. It's very exciting. And I've been involved with it over the years that I've worked at the Times. And since I've become the book editor, I've taken a role in helping to organize it. And it's a whole lot of work, but it's wonderful work. I really enjoy it.
Well, it is a wonderful event. And last week I was very happy that one of my guests was Deborah Johnson, who is going to be at the festival. She's the winner of the 2015 Harper Lee Prize for Legal Fiction with her book, The Secret of Magic. So I'm thrilled that I'm going to be able to meet her at the festival. And tell us about the event and how it's such an exciting event, and you have so many authors this year.
Well, we do. We have more than 50 authors, as a matter of fact. And the event is free. It's free to everyone. It's on Saturday, October 24th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on the campus of USF St. Petersburg on the bayfront in downtown St. Pete, which is a really beautiful venue and easy to get around on. And we have our fingers crossed for beautiful weather. If we get the kind of weather we have today, we'll be really happy.
Because it is a gorgeous location.
Yeah, it is. It is. And the authors really seem to enjoy it, too. And as I said, we have more than 50 authors. Some of them are local or Florida authors. Some of them are nationally best-selling authors who come to us from all over the place. So we have a really nice range. I think we have something for, no matter what your reading tastes are, I think we have something for just about everybody.
Well, that's true, because you have all types of books. Tell us about the various types. I know that you have a very exciting author, General Anne Dunwoody.
Yes.
I think her story is so exciting, and I think many people will be excited to come out and meet her.
I think so, too. She is. She was the first female four-star general in the U.S. Army.
Wow.
She's the fourth generation in her family to serve in the military, and she's recently retired after, I believe, a 37-year career, and she's written a book called A Higher Standard that's kind of a combination of a memoir and a leadership guide. She ran a 69,000-person command that was basically the command that supplied the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. So she's a really remarkable woman, and I think, yes, a lot of people are going to be very interested to meet her. She's one of our headliners. And another one of our headliners, of course, is Judy Blume.
Oh, yes.
Much beloved children's author who sold, I forget, it's more than 50 million books over the years. And her new book is called In the Unlikely Event, and it's a novel for adults. It's a longer novel than the books that she writes for younger readers, but it's a really terrific book, and we're really thrilled she's going to be joining us.
Well, it is a wonderful opportunity for readers and of course writers to meet her and to hear her comments on writing in general. I know she's claiming that this is going to be her last book tour. I think you know the writers do that, but then something comes along. But just in case, I think everyone should definitely come out. I know my boys were hooked on fudge when they were young, and I know you know the kids all enjoy that, and it's a wonderful. The nice thing about this event is that I know she will be one of your headline speakers, and she's she's I think right early in the day, right at
she's at 10 o'clock.
So the the festival starts at 10 o'clock, and throughout the day So for people who haven't been to a reading festival, so that they understand, they can go online to see the schedule. And then they can pick which, you know, which authors they want to see and move around for the entire day and get to hear the, you know, from the authors that they really want to know something about. And there's more than just authors there. What else is happening at this event? Because it's an exciting, you have really turned this into an exciting event.
Well, we have a book market with more than, I believe this year, more than 40 vendors. Some of them are booksellers, you know, bookstores or organizations. Some of them are single authors and you know, sort of assorted other vendors. We have food trucks and so forth. We have we'll have a performance by American Stage of Charlotte's Web. We have some music planned and lots of other things. And the schedule, as you say, is online at festivalofreading.com. And also in Thursday's Tampa Bay Times, inside the weekend section, readers will find a printed version of the schedule that has all of the authors' locations and times, and also has a map of the campus and parking and all of that. So that'll be in Thursday's Times, and that section, that guide, festival guide, will also be available free at the event.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to have available, so that people can make a decision beforehand of where they want to go.
Right.
I know, as I said, you know, it's a wonderful event for both men and women. You know, a husband and wife can go, and you can break up and go to, you know, women can go to the writers they want, and men can go to the writers that they want. And I know, like, one of the writers that I know, a lot of guys, and of course me, I'm a big baseball fan myself. Dwayne Statz is going to be there.
Yes, he has a new memoir that he co-wrote with a local author named Dave Scheiber, and it's both about his career and about his personal life. And yeah, they're going to be speaking. Yeah, we try really hard to have, you know, both fiction and nonfiction. We have different genres. We have horror writers. We have romance writers. We have mystery writers. We have young adult authors. We have Pulitzer Prize winning journalists with their books. We just really try for that wide range.
Well, of course, Dwayne Statz is the sort of the voice of the Tampa Bay Rays, and he will be, I'm sure, very popular. And then, of course, you have a very beautiful actress who's going to be there.
People
don't know. I'm sure most people don't realize that she is also an author and a poet.
That's right. That's Amber Tamblyn, who most people know from things like, well, she was on General Hospital when she was just a kid.
I remember her.
For many years, yeah. And she was the star of Joan of Arcadia and Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Oh, that was a great one.
And she's been in, most recently, she was in 2 and a Half Men during its couple last season or two. And she's a very talented actress, and many people know her as that. But in fact, she has also been, she published her first poem when she was 12. And she's a very serious poet. And this is her third book of poetry. It's called Dark Sparkler, and it's published by HarperCollins. And it's a very impressive book of poetry, and it's the poems, many of the poems are based on the lives and deaths of other actresses, some of whom are famous, like Marilyn Monroe and Sharon Tate and people like that, and some of whom are unknowns. But the subject of, you know, what happens to women in show business and the kind of demands that are put on them interested her, because, of course, that's her life, too. But she's made something very impressive out of that, and I think people are going to be very interested to see her, to hear her read her poetry and talk about it. I think she was actually with us a few years ago, and this is a return visit, so I'm very excited that she's coming back.
There, as you said, that you have such a diverse range of people who are going, authors who are going to be there, and that's the wonderful thing about, well, knowing you, and of course you love to read like I do, and I think after the crossword, when I get the newspaper, I do the crossword first, and then I feel like if I've done the crossword, I can, you know, read everything else. But the first thing I always do turn to actually is your reviews, because being in the book business myself, I'm always interested in what you have to say. So it must be thrilling for you. Most of these books, at some point or another, you've reviewed, and
most of the ones by the authors we're presenting this year, I've had some help from some other staffers with a few of the books too. So I haven't read every single one of those 55 books, but I sort of feel as if I have.
Well, it's great. Now I know that I noticed that the Poet Laureate of Florida is going to be
Peter
there,
mm-hmm.
And yeah. He is—he's the outgoing Poet Laureate, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, he is outgoing as the Poet Laureate of St. Petersburg.
Uh-huh.
He is newly named the Poet Laureate of the entire state of Florida.
Okay.
So he is stepping up
from local
Poet Laureate to statewide Poet Laureate.
Well, that's great.
That's Peter Meinke, of course,
yes.
Who was formerly a professor at Eckerd College. And he'll be passing on the local Poet Laureate laurels to Helen Pruitt Wallace, who is a St. Petersburg poet, and then, rising to his new position. And he also has a new book, a children's book, that he and his wife, Jeannie, who is an artist, collaborated on, and it's called The Elf Poem, and it's for children, and it's to help children write their own poetry, and it's a very charming book, and they'll be talking about, he and Jeannie will be talking about that as well.
Well, one of the things I do on my program is I do encourage people, of course, to write. I believe that everyone has a book in them, at least one book in them. And there is so much joy in getting your words down on paper. And whether it's a book that, you know, is just for your family and your friends, or a book that is worthy of being published, it's still fun to actually go through the process of writing. You learn so much about yourself, and you never know where it's going to lead. Recently, I interviewed a woman who's quite, you know, beyond the retirement age, let's say, and she had never thought that she would become a writer. And suddenly, she found the time and the energy, and she put it down on paper, and she's having a very successful run with her book. And I think poetry is always one of the great ways, sort of an entry into just starting to get words down on paper. And so I think it'd be wonderful for people to come out and see Peter Meinke, to see his new book. I think it would be really great.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think so too.
Yeah, because I just interviewed the new Poet Laureate for the United States, Juan Felipe Pereira. He was on my program last month, and he said one of the things he loves to do is to encourage children to write poetry, because there's something natural in children that when they sit down and you say write a poem, and it can be anything they want, it's amazing what they come out with.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And that's what Peter and Jeannie's new book is about, too, is to encourage kids to write poetry and show them ways that they can do it. So they're on the same wavelength with Mr. Herrera, who is a wonderful poet.
Oh, he is. He is. And I have a feeling Peter Meineke is going to follow in his footsteps in a few years, because
that would be nice.
I think his poetry is great, too, because I do love poetry. It's a way to encourage people to start looking. You know, sometimes people have to read little things before they start reading big things. And So, as I said, I was so happy when I got to interview Deborah Johnson about her The Secret of Magic, which is an amazing book. And
It's a terrific book.
So I'm sure everybody's going to really enjoy meeting her. And, of course, many of the authors are open to having selfies taken with them. And this is something
they like meeting their fans.
Oh, they do. It really is thrilling for them to get to meet their fans and sign the books and have that interchange of ideas. So I want to encourage everyone to come out. So tell me, I understand quite a few of your own people from the Tampa Bay Times are involved in different projects that or books that they have written?
We have several Times staffers. Well, we'll have a presentation, and it's not really based on a book, but we're going to have a presentation by our PolitiFact team, our fact-checking journalists. And since we're, rolling into yet another election year, they're going to talk about how they fact-check the news and the people who make the news, and they're actually going to be doing live fact checking. So people who are interested in that can see the process that they go through, and that will be a panel that has the Times editor Neil Brown, and then three of the staffers who work on PolitiFact or Pundit Fact, Josh Gillen and Katie Sanders and Aaron Shirachman. And we also have two Times, one Times current reporter, Lane DeGregory, and one Times alumna, Ann Hall, who now works at the Washington Post. And they both have stories in a new book called Newswomen, 25 Years of Front Page Journalism. And Ann and Lane are both Pulitzer Prize winners. And they will be talking about their stories that are in this book, and also about their work in general. They'll be on a panel together, so that'll be interesting. And also the Times critics, including myself, will all be speaking. We'll each be speaking separately, but I'll talk about my work, and Steve Persall, our movie critic, Jay Cridlin, who's our pop music and pop culture critic, and Andy Meacham, who is our performing arts critic, will also be appearing to speak.
Well, one of the books that I think will interest many people, including a lot of the writers who listen to my program, is Roy Peter Clark's book, How to Write a Short Story. And I know that he's going to be speaking.
Right. He's one of our perennials. Yeah. He's always with us, and he's always very entertaining. He's the only speaker we have who plays the piano as part of his presentation and works in rock music and all kinds of performance. He's a great entertainer as well as a great writing coach. And his most recent, he has a number of books. His bestseller is called How to Write Well, and his latest book is How to Write Short, WordCraft for Fast Times. And he's just for people who are writers or want to be writers, yes, he's a terrific speaker. He has lots of great advice. So people should pencil him into their schedule if they're interested in writing themselves.
And he's not the only performer. I understand you also have the American Stage is putting on a performance.
Yeah, they're going to be doing a version on, it's outside of the Student Center, on a stage outside the Student Center of Charlotte's Web.
Oh, that's fantastic.
The children's book, Charlotte's Web.
Well, Colette, it sounds like an amazing program that you've put together, and the Tampa Bay Times 23rd Annual Festival of Reading is free. And so it's a fun all-day event, and people can find out more about it at what website should they go to?
festivalofreading.com. And I'll mention one thing. The event's free. Authors will all be signing their books after they speak. And we have all those books available for sale, Barnes & Noble, USF St. Pete handles all the book sales. So if you come and hear an author and you want to buy that author's book and have it signed while the author is there, you can do that without having to go anyplace else to get a book. They'll be available for sale.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Colette Bancroft, the very, very popular book editor of of the Tampa Bay Times. And I just want to thank you so much. As I know, I will come in and hear your speech. You were so wonderful when you spoke to my group before, and I'm looking forward to hearing you again. So thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, and thank you so much.
Okay. See you Saturday.
All right. See you then.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye now. And do go out and see the Tampa Bay Times Festival on Saturday. And meanwhile, hold on, and we'll be right back to talk about with Jim Shapiro, who has written a fascinating book called The Year of Lear, 1606. It's a year in the life of Shakespeare. And we'll be right back.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Let's go bowling!
Let's go bowling, heard on the Tan Talk Radio Network every Wednesday, 11 a.m. to 12 Eastern Time, sponsored by 12 Strike and Innovative Ball Spinner. If you bowl, if you haven't bowled in a while, or if you never bowled, why not you be one of 65 million people have bowled last year? Listen to the tip of the week, bowling stars, old and new. Let's go bowling show, gobowlingshow.com.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind a book. My guest today is James Shapiro, author of a wonderful new book called The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. Hi, James, are you there?
I am, and it's great to be on your show.
Okay. Do you like to be called James or Jim?
Jim is best.
Jim is best. Okay. Well, Jim, you know, this is a fantastic book. You have, of course, you have written a previous book about Shakespeare, and of course, that was another special year in the life of Shakespeare. It was 1599. It was a year in the life of William Shakespeare, 1599. And now we are jumping to 1606, which was an exciting year that nearly started off with a bang.
So it did. You know, it's funny, 1599, I wish these books took me a year to write. 1599 took me 15 years. This one took me another 10. So it's 25 years of work between those two volumes.
Oh, boy. And I've heard from people who say they want you to write a book for every year of Shakespeare's life. So it means you have to live a long, long life.
At this rate, even though it's getting a little faster, I don't think I'll manage even to do another one. But it's very generous for people to think that. But you're right, 1606 almost started off with a bang.
And let's explain that. In this era of terrorism, we sometimes don't remember that there were terrorists before. And in 1606, this was a particular time where we came very close to a major terrorist event. So tell us about it.
It's funny. Those of us who lived through 9/11 and learned its lessons, however complicated they may be, are in a better position to understand plays like Macbeth than an earlier generation. In November of 1605, right before the end of that year, a group of disaffected young Catholic men who felt that King James was never going to give the Catholics their due in England decided to take matters into their own hand, and they planted 36 barrels of gunpowder underneath the House of Lords and expected that they would be able to blow it up when King James and the political and religious leadership and the whole royal family was gathered at that spot on November 5th. And only at the last minute was this large-scale terrorist attack that might have killed one out of every seven Londoners as well, including Shakespeare, for all we know, was it prevented. And the early months of 1606 were spent torturing, trying, and brutally executing the surviving plotters and their Jesuit handlers. So it was a grim year, and it was really the first time in England that the nation had to deal with a terrorist threat, asking questions like, where does evil come from? Does this come from the devil? Is it their religion? Does it come from the mind of men? So it's a year that resonates, I think, very powerfully for our own times.
And, of course, the influence on Shakespeare's work it was enormous. And tell us about those plays of that time. What?
Sure. Shakespeare had started writing King Lear in 1605, and events kind of overtook a play that was already engaged with many of these political and social divisions. The play that is most responsive to this moment was Macbeth, and to a lesser extent, a third play in which he wrote this year, Antony and Cleopatra. Macbeth is really considered a play that's written in the atmosphere of the gunpowder plot. The witches come on stage with squibs or fireworks. It almost smelled like gunpowder at the Globe Theater. And it's a play that is about equivocation. Macbeth speaks about the equivocation of the fiend. There are, of course, the equivocating three witches who lead him in a path to destruction. Even good characters in this play equivocate. And equivocate's a word that Shakespeare had used before, 6 years earlier, in Hamlet, and it was a neutral term. But by 1606, it had flipped meaning and become something really negative. Equivocation meaning to deceive intentionally, to think one thing and say another. And it was this change in its meaning was a direct outcome of the aftermath of the gunpowder plot when a treatise on equivocation was found in the lodgings of one of the plotters, a kind of how-to handbook on how to deceive those in authorities and lie under oath.
You know, when you're, of course, you write so
knowingly. You've spent so many years immersed in Shakespeare in these years. Many people don't realize it. When we think of Shakespeare, of course, people think of him as being an Elizabethan playwright. And not many people remember that there was a change there in power. And it was, of course, in 1606, it was a king and not Elizabeth who was in charge of England. And what was his relationship with the king?
That's a really great question, and you're right that we all think of Shakespeare as an Elizabethan. I spent 15 years writing a book, and the thought never occurred to me when I was writing 1599 that he was anything but an Elizabethan. And he wrote in his early years as a playwright about things that mattered to Elizabethans. What is Englishness? What's going to happen when our virgin queen, who has no children, Queen Elizabeth, is going to die? Are we going to be plunged back into the civil wars that he's writing about in all those Henry plays? The concerns of the young Shakespeare, the early Shakespeare, are Elizabethan ones. Well, Elizabeth dies in 1603, and people are really ready to get rid of the old woman, as they put it, and usher in a young king from, relatively young, from Scotland, who has two sons and a daughter and a wife. They never have to worry about succession again. And there's enormous optimism that quickly peters out as they realize he is not the ruler that Queen Elizabeth was. And the plays that Shakespeare's writing in 1606, he's writing as a king's man, because one of the first things that King James did when he came to the English throne was appoint Shakespeare's company to be the official royal playing company. So it's a mixed blessing. Shakespeare's performing at court with his company 10, 12 times a year, but he also has to walk a fine political line. He can't be a propagandist for the king and still write plays that people will come to see at the Globe, but he can't write too negatively about the king, who is his royal patron. So the problems Shakespeare faced in the new regime were both creative and political. And in fact, in the early years of the regime, Shakespeare was not writing so much. He needed to find his footing. And it was only in 1606, James's third year on the throne, that Shakespeare really did find his footing and began to write plays that spoke so powerfully to his times.
Somehow, one never imagine Shakespeare being a courtier, you know, dressing. You mentioned in there that he dressed in red livery.
Yeah, you know, when King James made him a king's man, Shakespeare was sent to get 4.5 yards of red cloth to make up an outfit that he was to wear on court occasions when he was called in to stand as a kind of attendant at court. I think of it as more doorman than courtier, you know, doormen who wear livery. And it was a mixed role. It wasn't high status, but it wasn't low status. But it gave Shakespeare incredible access to the mechanisms of power, so that when England was negotiating a treaty with Spain in 1604, Shakespeare spent 18 days in a row attending upon the Spanish embassy. So he got to understand and transmute into his plays how power worked.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's the wonderful thing really about this book, is that it expands our whole view of Shakespeare. We'd always sort of thought of him just hanging around the Globe Theater and writing his plays and having them produced, but to have this revelation of his involvement with the court, I think is so fascinating.
Well, when I took Shakespeare in junior high and high school in Brooklyn, I just hated it. I didn't understand it. It wasn't connected to the world that produced it. When I would see a movie like Saturday Night Fever about dancing culture in Brooklyn, I understood the relationship between the art and the times. And I decided to spend my life trying to understand what the times were that shaped these now timeless plays. And I live in the past, and then when I'm done with these books, come back to 2015 in this case, and try to explain what it was like back then. And it is an immersive experience. It's an exhausting experience trying to imagine a world we have lost. But I'm hoping that it will give readers who are similarly alienated by Shakespeare a kind of way into his plays.
Well, reading your book, of course, is a history lesson in itself. You touch on so many aspects of history. Of course, the relationship of England and Spain at the time, and the whole sort of opening up of communication between the countries.
It's, you know, one of the things we don't really think about because we study them in different classes or read them in different ways is two of the greatest writers of the time, Cervantes wrote Don Quixote in Spanish, and Shakespeare's writing plays like King Lear in English. We know that they died on the same day in 1616, but don't really think about how they might have influenced each other. When the peace treaty with Spain was signed, Englishmen went to Spain and quickly brought back great Spanish works, and Cervantes' Don Quixote was published in 1605, and English writers quickly translated it. And Shakespeare wrote a play, which sadly is now lost, called Cardenio, based on Cervantes. So it's really exciting to go back and see the ways in which these kind of cultural shifts led to creative changes as writers were allowed for the first time to engage different cultures and different traditions.
Well, Jim, you're so fascinating. I have to take a quick break. So, Jim, just hold on, and I'll be right back, okay?
Sure. This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Charles Ruttenberg Realty proudly sponsors Joy on Paper with Patsy Gill. Charles Ruttenberg sets the standard of excellence with residential and commercial real estate transactions and can help you on your next transaction, whether that is for a second home, investment, or downsizing. Call us today at 727-538-9200 extension 2 and allow me to help you. I'm John Rakowski, the broker at Charles Ruttenberg Realty.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Arg, matey. When it's time for lunch, when it's time for dinner, when the show's over, when the day's over, when it's time to chill, where do we go? Over to Naughty Nancy's Food Shack and Crow's Nest Pub. It's literally in our backyard, right in back of the WTAN studios at 700 Eldridge Street, just north of downtown Clearwater. Just look for the broadcast tower. Nancy's food and atmosphere get rave reviews. The laid-back patio is a great place to hang out, dine, and listen to live music at night. And Nancy's one of the friendliest proprietors in town. And now, Nancy is serving Sunday jazz brunch from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Brunch served with eggs benedict, crepes, waffles, lox and bagels, shrimp, oysters, and build your own omelet. That's all at Naughty Nancy's Food Shack and Crow's Nest Pub, 700 Eldridge Street in Clearwater. That's right where Eldridge crosses the Pinellas Trail between Myrtle and Fort Harrison. Call 446-3717. 446-3717. You're listening to the Tantalk Radio Network.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing, our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with a million-dollar view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, James Shapiro, author of a book about Shakespeare called "The Year in the the Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606." Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Well, you're called the foremost scholar of Shakespeare, from what I've heard about you, and of course, a bardologist, which is a nice word, bardologist. Tell me, you know, when you were doing this research for 1606. How easy was it to come across the information that you needed for that period?
I was lucky. The BBC asked me to do a 3-hour documentary that opened a lot of doors. It was a documentary about Shakespeare's life at the Jacobean court from 1603 to 1613. And all of a sudden, this kid from Brooklyn, who's a teacher and a scholar, was being invited into the National Portrait Gallery and the British Museum and the British Library and shown treasures that I didn't know existed. And archaeologists called me up and gave me tips about what was being unearthed from this year. So in addition to reading everything that I could in libraries at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington and in the British Library, I got to touch a lot of objects. And it was really through touching things and handling things that I got a physical, palpable sense of what that moment was. And again, I was very lucky that people were very generous to me and doors were open that facilitated this research.
Oh, that's exciting when you get to actually touch things and get a feel for the period. So when you were doing the research, now you read the old English that it's written in. You're very good at that. You can read the handwriting easily.
You know, that's a great question. I could read every handwriting but one. There was a mad astrologer doctor named Simon Forman whose manuscripts are in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and I'd still be there for another 5 years. I just can't read his handwriting. And luckily, there was a young woman named Lizzie Williamson who can read it like she was reading her own writing. And she helped me. I employed her, and she transcribed his material. But otherwise, yeah, I can read secretary hand is what they call it. And pretty good at figuring out the ways in which Jacobean writers wrote their letters.
Now, you mentioned a lost Shakespeare play.
I did, Cardenio.
And
might still be in somebody's attic for all we know. There was a copy of Titus Andronicus that was discovered in a Swedish postal office in 1906. So there are still discoveries to be made.
Oh, isn't that exciting to think about that? But, you know, maybe one day you'll be researching another year in the life of Shakespeare, and there you'll come across it. Wouldn't that be a wonderful discovery?
It would be very, very exciting. But to be honest, there are still discoveries being made. In the last few months, as I was putting the book together, a researcher in Edinburgh in Scotland came upon a story which nobody had ever heard of before about how Shakespeare, with his fellow actors, carved or cut his signature at his favorite hangout, the Tabard Inn, not far from the Globe Theater. It's a really small detail, but it opens up a view of Shakespeare as a kind of sociable creature, one who would hang out with friends, one who would carve his autograph into the wall of a pub. So, as I was saying, there are discoveries large and small. This is a small one, but each one reshapes our sense of Shakespeare in relationship to his world and humanizes him.
Are there any lost years where we know absolutely nothing about what Shakespeare was doing?
You know, to my great frustration, Shakespeare deliberately, it seems, kept a very low profile. And he wanted it that way. And that, of course, has created the mystery that some people believe, but we know is not the case. Somebody else wrote the plays and not Shakespeare. I think he wanted to be an actor and playwright, one who spoke to his own world, and secondarily, one whose works would be printed, half of them after his death by his fellow actors in the great First Folio of 1623. He's left us 35 to 40 plays, and that's what we have. We don't have as much biographical information as we would wish. So in 1606, he was really hard to track, and it was everything I could do to see him reflected in the glare of contemporary events and have his personality and his writing illuminated in that way.
Well, I had was working on a story, and part of the story was a hopeful idea that he actually took off for a year as a sailor, perhaps during the Armada years. Do you know anything about that?
I can tell you that if you read Shakespeare's plays, you will see that the nautical allusions, the stuff about sailing from Comedy of Errors down to The Tempest at the end of his career, would lead you to believe he had spent time as a sailor. The problem with that is, if you read his work and look for military terms, you'll be convinced he was a soldier. If you're looking at legal terms, you know for sure he had to be a lawyer. Doctors think he was a doctor. Teachers think he was a teacher. In the end, all I can say with confidence is Shakespeare was a great listener. He must have sat across from people from all walks of life, bought them a drink or two, and had them describe in the language of their own trade and profession what they did. And we think of Shakespeare as a great writer. He had to have been the greatest listener and just soaked up what everybody else was doing and makes you feel as if it had been his own experience. I'm not saying he wasn't a tinker, tailor, soldier, spy, but he couldn't have been all of them.
Well, you never know. He might have been the great imposter going around, taking on jobs and...
He may well have been. That is true.
You know, I like to think of him doing that because there are years that we don't know about, and I like to think of him doing that. So very funny.
The years that I will never write about Shakespeare are his 20s. They're a complete blank. The people in the Shakespeare world call them the lost years. Something must have led him from his native small town of Stratford, or driven him from there to London. But those 7 or 8 crucial years in his early 20s are lost to us. And
well, never
years,
say never. You
that's true.
You know,
right.
I have a feeling if anybody ever digs it up, it's probably going to be you.
It's nice of you to think, but I'm almost giving up.
No, you can't give up. You're too young to give up. I know that. Are you teaching full time?
I am. I just came from class before our conversation. It's really exciting. One of the nice things about teaching, and I've been teaching Shakespeare at Columbia University for the last 30 years, is that the students know so many things that I don't, and it just transforms my thinking about works that I thought I knew.
Well, your students are very lucky because, as you said, when you were young and they were shoving Shakespeare down your throat, you didn't appreciate it.
Exactly.
But that's because they didn't understand it the way that you do, that you do now, and that you put in your books. You know, your books are so full of research, but they just read. I mean, you just... they move. You know, it's so wonderful the way you write.
And I'm very grateful.
I'm so thrilled that I got to talk to you. And I hope that I will be able to talk to you again when you come out with this this great book, maybe in another 10 years, The Lost Years. And
well, if I discover a new play or a lost one, or if I get enough energy to do another year, I would love to be back on your program.
Okay, well, I would love to have you, and I want to thank you so much, Jim, for joining me today. I think that, you know, it's so wonderful that books are available, like, on Amazon so that people can go back if they get your book that's going to be – that's just been released, the Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606 – they can go back and get one about $15.99 too, and so it's a wonderful thing. And I want to encourage everyone to read this book. It's not just a book about Shakespeare; it's a book about history, and you put so many things in perspective. So thank you so much for joining me.
And it's been a great pleasure and a lot of fun talking.
And I envy your students, and maybe I'm going to have to come up to Columbia and take a course with you. Just to get to hear you.
That'll be fun.
Okay. So have a great day, and thank you so much for joining me on Joy on Paper, because I love to read.
Bye-bye.
Wow, that was fun. It was so great to talk to Jim, and I want everyone to go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any online bookstore and get The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. You will really enjoy Jim's book. It reads so beautifully, almost like a thriller, because it's a history and a mystery all rolled into one. Now, next week, please join me. I am going to have as my guest Robin Cook, who is going to talk about his latest medical thriller, which is going to be, I'm sure, number one best-selling book on the New York Times best-selling list. It's called The Host. It's a really scary book. I got a wonderful pre-publication edition, and I was reading it, and it just so happened that my husband had to have a knee transplant and a knee revision. And so I was reading that book in the hospital, and it's quite a thrilling book. You must join me next week to listen to Robin Cook talk about this latest in his line of mysteries. Also joining me next week is Carol J. Perry, whose third book in her Witch City mystery series is called Look Both Ways. Next Tuesday is her release date, and I know she is very excited to talk about how she has managed to turn her first book into a series of now 6 books. This is her third, and she just recently got a contract for 3 more. It's a wonderful story of perseverance and determination. And for all writers, it's really interesting to hear how a writer can work for years on different projects and then finally hit it just right. And Carol has done it. And do listen in next week. Meanwhile, remember, this is Patsy with a Z wishing you a great week. I want to thank Big Ed in the control room for everything he does for me. And remember, one of the joys in life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. Have a great week.